Well, hello out there in KYGT Radio Land. This is Lori Beckel with another edition of All People Considered here on KYGT, LPFM 102.7 and 103.9 on your FM radio dial. We love the fact that we are streaming worldwide at www.clearcreekradio.com. So it is my pleasure to bring you another edition of All People Considered. Thank you so much for listening. This program is brought to you by my company, Lori Fowler Beckel PC. I coach and train human service professionals in the high fidelity wraparound model. And as I've said often, wraparound honestly is about listening to people's stories, understanding what people need, and then putting a support team around them to give them the help they need to get on their feet. It's a wonderful model. You can actually Google it, wraparound. Anyway, so my company sponsors this program. I am delighted to be here today with my good friend, Jerry Fabianic. You all know Jerry Fabianic out there in our radio land. Jerry was one of the people who encouraged me to nurture this idea and actually put it into practice. And here he is now on my show. So welcome, Jerry. It's wonderful to have you here today.
Thanks, Lori. I'm thrilled to be here. There we go. Oh, I'm going to turn that mic up over there. The second knob. There we go.
There's
all right. Hey,
Jerry.
Now we got it. There we
so
go.
So let's say that again.
All right.
Jerry's delighted to be here.
Yeah, I am thrilled to be here. So, all right. There's so many knobs and sliders and switches, and we do it all. That's the amazing thing.
It's true. And, you know, Jerry and I, as is typical for us, get together and we start talking and there are a few details that sometimes get forgotten, like making sure he's live on his mic.
Oh, that's great.
So anyway, great to have you here. And, you know, you're on KGOAT often talking about a whole variety of things. But today we get to hear about you. And we get to hear about what brought you to Clear Creek County and, you know, where you came from. So take it away, Jerry Fabianic.
Oh, wow. Thanks, Lori. What brought me to Clear Creek? You know, I traveled through Clear Creek countless times back when after I moved to Colorado, I was living in Aurora and teaching there. And I ski primarily Winter Park Mary Jane. I hike in the summer, climb mountains, and so on. And my first memory of Georgetown actually was way back in the early 80s. And my mother and Aunt Liz were out to visit. And we came up to Georgetown and did a tour through, you know, and it was great. I really liked the community. So after I had moved here to Colorado from Pennsylvania, Western Pennsylvania, back in, well, I moved here in 76, and I got a job teaching, got into that, and after about 14 years or so of teaching, and it was about ever, and I remember it was in 1993, right at the end of the year, and I was just sitting there, you know, it was holiday break and I'm watching bowl games and I'm sipping on some beers and it hit me and I thought, I didn't move to Colorado to live here. And so the journey began and long circuitous events and I ended up landing a job at Summit High School and I bought a condo there, brand new. And I was all excited about moving into a condo, downsizing from a house. And then after I got in it, I realized I hated it. It was like living in a box of saltines on its side. or on its top, up and down. It was only 15 feet wide, three levels. And it was crazy busy there even then. That was back in the, you know, mid-90s. And I don't like living in Summit County. I loved my job. I loved everything about it. I just didn't like living there. So something just urged me and I said, okay. And I found this wonderful home in Georgetown that was in desperate need for TLC. Mm-hmm. And it's been a labor of love ever since. And so I've been here. I moved to, it's going on 24 years that I am living in that house in Georgetown and in Clear Creek County.
Wow. Well, we're glad you're here.
Thank you. I'm glad I'm here too, and I'm glad you're here. I just love it. It's just so many wonderful people. You know, one of the great things about Georgetown and, you know, all the small communities is that you have to stop and pick up your mail.
Yes,
it's and that's
true,
how you really
it?
Get to know people.
Yeah.
And you meet them and you see them and, you know, you go to the bank and, you know, they're there. And you just get to know a lot of people on a first name basis. And just they're all your friends and all your neighbors. It's such a small tight community.
Yeah. Library.
Yes.
They know you by name.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's true. There is a real feeling of belonging that you can have when you're in a small town, and you can belong in whatever way feels comfortable to you. But that sense of being in a place that you were meant to be and feeling so comfortable being there and so, and often so appreciated for being where you are, because people extend friendship and relationship, and it's just, we are very, very lucky.
We are. Yes, I like that, as if you were meant to be there.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, I moved to Colorado, and because of the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
I write that in my book, and I back in 1976, yeah, I'm getting my years, 75,
uh-huh.
I traveled here, and took a trip up through Rocky Mountain National Park, and was middle July, and climbed out on a snowfield and said, holy doo-doo. I didn't say doo-doo, but this is it. And made up my mind. And June 22nd, 1976, I call it my re-birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And I landed in Colorado, and it's been a journey and ever since, and never looked back.
Yeah. So you grew up in Western Pennsylvania.
I did. Mm-hmm.
We happened to connect about that because Monroeville, where you grew up, was a place that I worked for a while. And I remember finding the bowling alley.
Miracle
where where you used to work those years when you were a young teenager growing up in your very large family.
Yes.
I wonder how many people know how big your family was.
My mother had 13.
Yeah.
And one set of twins. So still 13 births,
right.
You know, but 12 pregnancies. And I come towards the end. I am the youngest of the boys, and I have two younger sisters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Growing up in a family, I'm assuming Catholic family. Yes, I know this because I've read your book.
Yeah, Mom was very, we were, and a few still are. I'm not. And she kind of drifted away from it towards the end there. You know, she still had her beliefs. You know, she would have her rosary and so on. But we were a very Catholic family. Yes, I can, 12 years of Catholic education.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And your dad passed, didn't he, when you were pretty young?
Yes, he did. He died in a hunting accident and I was not quite 4 years old. My mother was still pregnant with my younger sister, Angie.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, at that time.
And then needed to support all your entire family.
No, I tell you, it was an amazing story. You talk about women who pull it together, and she did, because after the tragedy, she was encouraged by family members and the church and others, friends, to put us younger ones, especially, up for adoption. or out in foster care or something. And she said no, and she refused to. And a large part of my perspective, life philosophy, comes from her modeling that.
Mm-hmm.
That she rallied around, and I say that was my mother's will, determination, and mm-hmm. FDR, Social Security,
mm-hmm.
That saw us through. There wasn't much, and we often had to go get the free food, and to this day, I still hate cornmeal mush. I hate it with a passion. My older brothers and sisters love it. They have these fond memories, and I'm going, like, oh, my God, it tastes like sand, you know. But sometimes that was the meal.
Yeah.
And
but the Social Security came from your father.
Yes.
And it was not a lot, but it was something.
It was enough to keep it going.
Because she needed to be there to take care of children, right?
Oh, in she the didn't home. Work. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so you learned how to, I still darn socks if I need to. I don't anymore. But boy, when there was a hole in your sock, you learned how to stitch it up. It's still on a button.
Mm-hmm.
You learned iron your own clothes. You just did everything because everyone had to chip in. And one of my, I say this about a sense of fairness, is that when she would go shopping, and if she had enough left over, 39 cents, at that time, a half a gallon of ice cream was 39 cents. And she had that left over, she would bring back the ice cream. And it was in a box, you know, mm-hmm. a wax box. It wasn't like a round tube now mm-hmm. like we get. And either she or one of my older sisters, they would unfold it and they would take a bread knife and slice the ice cream. So everybody got equal share.
Oh my
fair
gosh.
Was fair. Yeah. We had one bathroom.
Uh-huh.
That was it. And you called your time. When? You know, when I was a little boy, I bathed with my younger sisters. And then when I got a little older, then was my brother, and we just did that.
Mm-hmm.
And you just made do. And that's still so ingrained in me. And that it gets translated into my social political too.
Yeah, because it really shapes your culture as a human being. You know, your value system, as you say, your morals, your everything. Everything, how you spend money,
yes.
what you spend money on, that sense of fairness, and everyone really deserving an equal share. Yeah, I bet that does. That did help define a lot of your views.
My worldview is very much shaped by my upbringing. And
amazing, amazing mothers, huh? And
yeah.
You had one of those.
Oh, yeah. A real hero to me.
Uh-huh.
You know, and the fun part was, too, that we both believe, we dabble a little bit like in astrology. I'm Aquarius. She was Leo. So we were opposites.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she was the leader type and the outgoing. I'm more the cerebral and everything. But, you know, especially as a young man, I in one of my yearbook postings, a long story on how I got back to this, and there was a girl I went to high school with, and she wrote in there, never lose your sense of sarcastic sense of humor. And I'm thinking, Sharon, I haven't. But so when I was a young one, man, I can come back with a quick snips, and she and I would go back and forth. But the one time I would get her 9 out of 10 times, all good naturedly. But the one time she would get me was always in front of an audience, and it would be like, oh, you know, one of these. And she would just kind of, I remember like when
she
I was
saved it up for those most embarrassing
oh,
times.
Oh, she did. I went before I moved to Colorado, became a diehard Bronco fan. I was a diehard Steeler fan.
Oh, yeah.
And I would be in watching the game and jumping up and down, you know, and in front of the TV. And she came in and she go, losing again, huh? You know, and I just kind of look at her that she'd walk out, that she'd come in a little while later and she'd say, hit a homer, and, you know, like it's baseball. And I go, like, mother? You. But she knew what buttons to push, how to get, but it was all in love.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Very fun. So came up through the schools. And where did you go to college?
I got my bachelor's degree at the University of Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And I just reconnected with a classmate from my high school days, and I didn't realize she had gone there as well. And so we've been in a nice, email exchange, kind of getting to know each other again. But yes, I went to University of Pittsburgh, and I got my major was in political science, and my minor is in American history. And silly me, I wasn't, I had enough credits in English, I could have had at least a minor.
Oh.
But I didn't pursue it, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then it turns out that after I moved to Colorado, I got here and said, okay, now I need a job. So I start working at a Kmart. It's up on Colfax and Chambers Road in
Northeast
Aurora.
Really?
Yeah, that's where I work, in the sporting goods. And, so I'm working there and they wanted to transfer me and I didn't want to leave. I was just finding friends. I was just settling in and and I said, no. And I was in this really tough conundrum. What was I going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And I had two friends, Synchronicity. I met them. One I worked with at Kmart. Another one I met while I was bowling at Celebrity Lanes, if people remember Celebrity Lanes on Colorado Boulevard there. And I got talking to them in different times, and they asked me, and they said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, the only thing I ever wanted to be was a teacher. And they both said, well, be a teacher. And I went, well, I'm at the ripe old age of like 26, 27. How could I go back to school and
leave my job at Kmart?
Retail sales and everything. And that was such a life-changing experience for me. And I ended up at the University of Colorado in Boulder.
Uh-huh.
I got my teaching certification there. Started teaching at a middle school in Aurora. I loved it, but it was absolutely crazy. Friends to this day there, it was an open school, so no walls, just dividers. How we survived that, I have no idea. And then, as I say, back, it was in towards the end of 93, and I thought, this is all okay. I mean, I have my house, I have, it's a comfy job, it's good, I'm good at it. I have great friends, but that's not the reason I moved to Colorado. And so, the journey went on, and
the mountains were calling.
The mountains were beckoning here, and they still are. They have me, so wrapped up in here. It's my whole spirit and my everything here. So, and then also, I finished off my master's in education at University of Colorado, first at Boulder, then I finished in Denver.
I see.
They moved the program there.
Yeah, and were you teaching? Did you start teaching English or literature when you were in Aurora?
That's a great question. Yes, in a middle school, because of sometimes you're on a team,
mm-hmm.
you just don't have your own class.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were looking for occasionally people they could teach outside of their fields. Of course, I had social studies down, but I had enough credits in English and, I just happened to be a good writer and I read a lot. And so I started teaching what they call language arts.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I found my job at Summit High, at the first year, I was three classes of social studies and three of English one.
Mm.
And I loved it. And then the second year, the principal, Jim Anastasio, says, well, we need to hire another teacher, either English or social studies. So you decide. And I said, English. I want to stay here.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a real boost of confidence when the chair of the department came a couple of years later, and she said, another one in the department said, we want you to develop our Honors American Lit class for juniors.
Wow.
And I said, I don't even have a degree. And they said, you're better. You got it. So I did. And I ended up teaching American Lit at the honors, especially at the honors level. And I even covered for IB in the high school or at the senior level on occasion too. So,
wow.
Yeah, it was, it's just like a natural for me. I frequently, that maybe I should do that just for fun. Go back and get a master's, in English or something. And then, there's other things I want to do in life too. So who knows? We'll see where the journey goes.
Well, and I think I remember talking with you about your real love of teaching that honors class.
Yes.
And with that those junior students,
yes,
and the books that you taught, and I think Gatsby, right?
Gatsby was one.
Was one of them. Yeah. What were the other ones that?
I taught the, it was a survey course from the beginning. So we started with the Age of Faith with the Puritans coming.
Okay.
In that context, we read the Scarlet Letter, mm-hmm. and I dragged them through kicking and screaming, even though it's was written in the Romantic period. It's a transcendentalist novel, but the setting is, you know, and I would read it with them because it...
The language is a little... Right.
Yeah, it's archaic, you know. Mm-hmm. Hawthorne, yeah, it can be heavy. The honors levels could get through it, but the regular juniors, they go like, okay, this is... But I would read with them,
mm-hmm.
and by doing so, because I would make it relevant to them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's Hester Prynne up there. She's pregnant.
Yeah.
And so the community is condemning her.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about Papa?
Yeah, who happens to be the minister, right?
It is, yeah. Arthur Dimmesdale, Dims, you know, not very bright guy, you know, but, so we would talk about that and, you know, and they're juniors, they're 16, 17, so they understand,
yeah.
you know, the nature of things. And we would have some really great discussions based off of that, you know, bringing it back to their own personal experiences. You know, if a girl gets pregnant in high school, you know, how is she judged? Yet the boy is judged differently. And you know, of course, the girl's going, yeah, you know. But it really would ferment great conversations. And the lights went on for them.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, we really have not left some of those very important issues with any kind of reasonable resolve.
Right.
Star Trek resolve, as I say. Hopefully we'll finally get there eventually in the future at some point. But yeah, so I do remember, and Gatsby talked about. And
Huck Finn.
And Huck Finn.
That was my favorite to teach.
Uh-huh.
It really was. And Mark Twain, classic. He's right up there, you know, at the top of my list among authors. And I loved his sense of humor and, you know, wry point of view and everything, social commentary. I still have to read him periodically. I have his biography and a lot of his works in anthology, a lot of his works. I just pull up, refresh my brain, how much he has contributed to American culture,
mm-hmm.
and how, and it was Ernest Hemingway who said, American literature really begins with one book, and that is The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn.
Mm-hmm.
And, they were reading because they people, oh, it's just a boy going down the river and everything. And no, this is really deep, you know, and he's with Jim, who's the runaway slave, who becomes his father in there because his pap is just an old drunk and everything.
Yeah.
And so we talk about that role of father.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the other characters are in there, you know, the Duke and the King and all these others. But that one poignant moment in the story that what I would read with them. And it's when Huck is torn with his conscience.
Mm-hmm.
Society and even his religion says he has to turn Jim in. That's the law of the land.
Oh.
And remember, Christianity was divided at that time over slavery.
Mm-hmm.
In the South, they found passages in the Bible that defended it. In the North, just the opposite. So he writes this long letter to, I think it was Polly,
mm-hmm.
spacing that out right now, but that Jim is with me. And Jim knows what he's going to do. And so he reads the, you know, he's reading the letter over, and it's like, okay, I got to get this to them. And then he starts like going through his conscience, and he says, oh my God, he says, Jim, he's been everything to me. He's been, you know, like a father. He's helped me do this. He helped me do that, you know, like this. And yet, what do I do? And he's caught betwixt here and there, you know, what do I do here? And so he finally takes the letter, tears it up, and he says, all right, then, I'll go to hell.
Mm-hmm.
That was a moment in time there
yeah.
to say that he would risk his immortal soul because he was not going to turn in his dad,
yeah.
basically his father there.
Yeah. Right.
And that to me was one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful lines in American, in literature, period.
Wow. I'm going to need to now go find that.
Yeah. Oh, I got it all marked.
read it out loud. Oh, wow. No. And again, an issue that is still with us. Yeah. Everything about race relations in this country of ours. And wow, amazing. And going back and reading literature.
Yes.
That we see these same issues and can have, you know, hopefully really valuable conversations with each other and young people.
Yes.
So fabulous. Well, if you recognize that voice that's on All People Considered this afternoon with me, that is the voice of K-Goat DJ. Do you call yourself a DJ?
A radio host.
Play
music,
that's
per
right.
se, but I can say host.
Yeah, radio host.
DJ's fine, too.
Here on KYGT, Jerry Fabianic. And how fun it is to, you know, get under, are we under your skin? Get under your skin. Really learn more of the history of Jerry and his growing up and his arriving in Colorado and then his arriving in Clear Creek County. But this is Lori Beckel with All People Considered. Thank you so much for listening out there. You are listening to us on 102.7 and 103.9, streaming on clearcreekradio.com. So, so Jerry, let's continue. We're really learning about your love of reading and your love of literature. And at what point did you decide to write your own?
Oh, wow. Well, I did not start out and never had an intention to write a novel. Uh-huh. I love them, but particularly fiction is a lot tougher to write, for me anyway, than my normal articles for the paper and blog entries.
Mm-hmm.
The fiction gets into some really deep stuff. You're dealing with archetypes, particularly if you're writing in like the genre I prefer, and that's literary fiction,
mm-hmm.
which is really character driven, as opposed to perhaps like a murder mystery, like mm-hmm. a whodunit,
mm-hmm.
A romance novel. Okay. You know, the characters are developed, but it's the whole story. Whereas in literary fiction, it's really about the character and how he, she moves through events in life. And, I had, as I say, not intended to write a novel, but some years ago, I was, you know, probably 14, 15 years ago, I decided it was probably time that I officially came out to my family as a gay man.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I write a letter and I send it to all my siblings. My nephews and nieces shrugged and said, "What's new?" They knew it, you know. There was a couple of members of the family who had a little concern at that time, but really what pushed the envelope was to when I proposed writing a biography of our dad.
Oh.
And one sibling in particular was not thrilled about that. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of stuff started coming down. And one way I was able to cope with it was, well, there's two ways. One, I started running all the more.
Mm-hmm.
I just ran a lot, just burning that energy out. Mm-hmm. And I started to just basically journal and writing. And then this character came to mind and he evolved. His name is Jonathan.
Mm-hmm.
And I drew on Jonathan Livingston Seagull,
mm-hmm.
you know, literary guy.
Mm-hmm.
And in a novel or a story started taking shape. And, I remembered our upbringing, the Catholic Church, the old traditional Latin Tridentine Mass, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And so
I learned so much about that, yeah. actually, in the book.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And, uh-huh. and I tried to do enough to get the flavor, because what I've noticed, too, that when people read, particularly if they're older Catholics, former Catholics, or even still Catholic, they get so much of it, whereas non-Catholics go like, whoa, I wasn't aware of this. And,
right.
you know, this is new stuff and everything, too. So, at any rate, yeah, I started to... just put it in story form, and it started to take shape. And, you know, I decided, well, I'm a mountain man, and what better place to start and end it is on a mountain. That's where my energy, that's my spirituality, everything is. And so I had put that in and written on it. And after I found this really fabulous editor, Melanie, and after she read the manuscript and we got together and what needed to be done to really tighten it up, and she said, well, you know, and the initial name of the story, title for the story, is Requiem for a Family, because I was talking about the death of a family, and I was really focusing on Tom Wolfe, but that's not him, the one who wrote In the South. Okay, I'll think of it in a minute. Oh, Pat Conroy.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah, yeah.
Prince of Tides.
Prince of Tides,
Prince of
sure.
Tides. Mm-hmm. And how powerful of a novel that story is. And that's my kind of literature. Mm-hmm. So I had that in mind. And when Melanie and I were talking, then, okay, where do I move forward? And she said, what do you think the cover? And I said, well, I was thinking maybe like of a casket in front of a church with a black drape over it. Then I looked there and I said, who do want to buy a book with a casket on a front and wrote, you know, like this? And she says, well, I was thinking of a mountain, which tied in with the theme.
Right.
And I said, okay, you're right. And it's not just any mountain. It has to be Mount of the Holy Cross.
The Holy Cross.
Because
sure.
of Jesus
yeah.
carrying a cross.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then the title didn't fit. So we started, you know, palavering over that. What's this? And then after a few moments, we both looked at each other and said, Sisyphus wins. Because
yeah.
I bring Sisyphus, the story of that, through a couple of times.
Yeah.
With Albert Camus and his philosophy and so on.
Right.
And that's how I got the title. And the cover is a picture of the Mount of the Holy Cross. So, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And the hike you took, one of the hikes, is in the book, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And because I made
it. In fact, I've been inspired by that to want to climb that mountain.
You haven't done?
I have not done Mount of the Holy Cross.
Yeah, and either you prepare for a long day or camp over.
Mm-hmm.
And I prepared for a long day. And so that initial account where I have Jonathan falling as he's descending
right.
down into the valley there.
Yeah.
That literally happened.
Mm-hmm.
I was so exhausted that day, and I was bound and determined. And next thing you know, man, I am doing a face plant. And rocks and roots, everything. And it was like, oh, you know. So I recount that in the story, bring that in. So that's true right there.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of the others, there's a few years before, I had met this young man climbing Elbert,
mm-hmm.
and a brilliant young man. And he was from Massachusetts and had a Boston accent and everything. And we just really connected. And he passed me on the way up, and then we got to the top. He was completely unprepared. He didn't have the right clothing. He didn't have any backup water. He had nothing to eat. And fortunately, I brought more than enough for me. And I said, well, would you like, you know, and I had some Gatorade there. Yes, please, you know. And then, well, I got an extra sandwich here. Would you like? Yes. And so we really connected. And so I drew on that character, and I wrap him in to that hike on. Then I move it over to Mount of the Holy Cross.
Holy Cross. Wow.
So literary, you know, I'm allowed that, you know.
Yeah.
Freedom as a writer.
For sure. Well, and your book. So your book was published. Did you self-publish your book?
I did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's sold a lot of copies, right?
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
In fact, I just got a little report, and I think it was from, is it Amazon? Yeah. So I got, you know, because now I have the royalties coming in, and so
right.
as long as I'm alive, I got the royalties coming in. It's not much, you know, but it's so well worth
it. It must be thrilling, though. And to have, you know, a story that you kind of poured your heart and soul in.
Everything.
Yeah.
It's my life story. I call it memoir-ish.
Yeah.
It's a work of fiction. I change circumstances, like Jonathan growing up. He's a good little Catholic boy, just like I was. But the number in the family, I needed a large family. My mother, as I said, had 13. So it was getting unwieldy. So
all those people.
Yeah, you develop all those characters and so on. And so I reduced it down to 10 and went from there.
Yeah. Wow, amazing. Well, you know, it's really fun to have a published, acclaimed writer in our midst.
Well, thank you.
And you know, the writing continues. I think I asked you if you were thinking about writing another novel or another book, and I think you weren't real sure you were going to engage in that endeavor again.
Yeah, and I'm finding where strength lies, and I would say that my strength lies more in, like, with my articles for the newspaper, because they're very objective. Social commentary, I could research it, and there it is. And then I run a blog, and I write on what I call higher living reflections. So, again, it's nonfiction. Mm-hmm. Fiction is difficult, and something I'm working around it, and I still have to resolve this myself, because after I figured the novel's one and done, that's it. Mm-hmm. Well, then people read it and they go, well, what happens to Daniel? What happens to Benjamin Stephanos? What happens, you know, does Jonathan, you know, like, oh, okay, there's stories there. But this, you know, there's a first one, Sisyphus Wins, as I say, is memoirish. So I draw on a lot of life experiences. Mm-hmm. The next ones, though, because I've already told that story.
Right.
So now I'm creating from whole cloth other stuff now.
Yeah.
And it's not the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I wrote this whole draft out. I even had it edited, and I'm just not happy with it at all. So I don't know if I'm going to move forward with it. Probably not. And maybe just go back to ground zero. And I might even just go back, say, one and done, and it's been great. And because I still have all this other stuff, I'm so involved with so many authors around Colorado. They come on my show called Writer's Talk. I have a universe that's opened up to me. So I don't worry about it. In those moments, I sit and, you know, like, okay, see how this feels. And writing just has to be a creative endeavor. You just have to sit and do it. And who knows, next week, maybe tomorrow, a different bug might bite me in terms of where I go with perhaps a next work of fiction.
Yeah.
And totally get off of this other one and go somewhere else. So, you know, the journey, you put one foot in front of the other and see, and all of a sudden there's a trail going off this way. And it's like, okay, maybe I'll go explore this one for a little bit and see what happens. That's what life is.
Well, you really clearly describe for us the journey that became Sisyphus Wins, and really started with a purpose and a lot that was kind of agitating within you. That then became this memoirish novel, but a novel with a purpose, such a clear purpose. And I know you pretty well, and you're a man with a purpose. I can't imagine you just sort of going off willy-nilly to do something just because.
The spontaneity and all the...
I mean, you're spontaneous, yes, but you stay in your lane oftentimes of a clear purpose, I think, a lot of the time.
I think you're right. I say my one guru in life is Joseph Campbell.
Uh-huh.
And his whole about mythologies, and people all over the world are still trying to answer all the same questions they have for ever since we evolved back 100,000 years ago in the savannah of Africa. Why are we here? What's going to happen when we die? And, you know, and how did we get here? Mm-hmm. And he talks about mythologies, and we all have them, you know. So as far as I'm concerned, any type of spiritual religious belief is a mythology. It's your myth. And I don't you mean that in a derogatory, but in a very positive way. Mm-hmm. It's helping you answer questions that are befuddling, because none of us know why we're here, how we got here, what's going to happen when we die. Okay, there's no one coming back saying, aha, I got the answer. Okay, so, and then his idea of the hero's path, the journey,
mm-hmm.
that one goes out and just kick back a little bit to teaching. When I taught my freshmen, I was to teach the Odyssey, and I loved it. I studied the Odyssey in college. And I have a lot of Greek art and history and literature in my college resume. And I realized that, that I needed something more to make the Odyssey come alive. And I just, that's when I came across Joseph Campbell's original, that series with Bill Moyers, The Power of Myth.
Right.
And I watched it and I went, holy crap, this is it right here.
Yeah.
And of course, he talks about Star Wars, Luke Skywalker, and that journey. It is Odysseus. It's the Odyssey in the future. It's for our time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually would show the original Star Wars, and they would, oh, we get to watch a movie, and say, but you will know. And they did know the epic hero, the path of the epic hero.
Uh-huh.
And then I would correlate the Odyssey with the Star Wars. So my life is very much that. It hasn't changed. And it's just like, don't look over your shoulder and let, you know, it's, I remember I had this professor, John Haas, in at the University of Colorado. And he said, people that are constantly looking behind them, it's just like driving your car with your eyes glued to the rearview mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's helpful to glance in that every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But your eyes need to be focused on the road ahead of you.
Right.
And that's to me, you know, okay. The past is the past. You learn from it a little bit, but, you know, it's the present. Stay in the present, mm-hmm. you know, and anticipate as best you can the future, because you never know what's going to happen. Great stuff can happen, and sometimes some not so great stuff can happen.
Yeah.
So there you are.
A little bit easier for some of that kind of stuff if your eyes are forward and you may be a little more prepared.
Yes.
To react.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. You know, and you can't be prepared for everything, but,
right.
you know, like yesterday I did the hike up Herman's Gulch and a lot of snow at the top, and I was post-holing it through to the lake. And
oh, you got to the lake, though.
I did, but I'll tell you, that last ascent, there's a lot, and you have to kind of know where the trail is, and then you follow the dirty footprints, and then you travel through. And then when I was on my way back down, there was a group of about six people, and they're, you know, 50-ish, whatever, and their goal was the lake. And I said, well, you get that far, be prepared to post-hole. And one of the guys says, what's that mean? I said, it's when you step on snow and you go all the way down, your leg is doesn't even hit bottom, and then you got to get the next one. He goes, I don't think we want to do that. And I said, just a heads up.
Wow.
You know, so you have to be prepared, you know, for, you know.
Yeah.
And
Is the ice off that lake? Or
no.
Is it still full
no,
of ice?
No, it's still covered. I wouldn't ice skate on it or put a Zamboni on it, but it's still relatively white glazed.
Yeah. Wow. So interesting this summer with so much snow, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so I'm really curious about your articles. Your weekly articles in The Current, you mentioned them a minute ago, that they continue to be a way you exercise your need to write. And your articles are, you know, social commentary, as you've mentioned, well-researched. You provide really a lot of foundation for any commentary you make. But I'm interested in this community. What kind of responses do you get from our community?
Well, when you put yourself out there in the public, whether it's writing an article or putting a book out there, you're fair game.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I first started writing, it was back in 2003, and Megan Murphy was the editor at the time,
mm-hmm.
and she had a little blurb in the paper, we're looking for local writers, and I went, well, I used to teach English, and I never took journalism per se, I had a class or two, something, but, you know, what the heck. So I started writing, and I was particularly targeting, that's when Bush invaded Iraq, and I was very opposed to the invasion.
Mm-hmm.
And wrote about it, and I started getting some very pointed pushback mm-hmm. in letters to the editor. And at mm-hmm. first, it was like unnerving. It was like, oh, my God, you know. Well, one of the things you learn is you develop a crocodile alligator hide,
mm-hmm.
okay? And everyone's entitled to an opinion, and if you're going to be out there, you're, you know. So my articles, my writing has evolved over these, I've been writing since the first one was in September, October of 2003. So I'm going on 16 years now.
Wow. Yeah.
Writing for The Current and finessing it, tightening it up. You know, I used to be able to write 750 words and, you know, now, you know, we really try to keep it down to like 600, but that it really forces you to, what is your point? Get right to it.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, research. I was a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And it is important that you have solid research. I would tell my students that if in your work cited, you put Wikipedia in there as your source,
mm-hmm.
you just now have a D for your paper. I'm not even going to go any farther than that.
Mm-hmm.
You can use Wikipedia, but to get to these other that are authentic sources, so we would talk about that. That's important to me.
Mm-hmm.
That you know, you use verifiable, confirmed sources of, for your information, authorities on topics. Next week's article, I'm wrapping it up, and a new term for me. It's called ekphrasis, and it comes from the Greek.
Ekphrasis,
E-K, mm-hmm. and then like the word phrase, only S-I-S.
Mm-hmm.
And it's how when you look at a picture, a work of art,
mm-hmm.
and you interpret it in some way, you fill in the details, you observe it.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, it's about that photograph recently of that father and that boy they found dead on the banks of the Rio Grande River.
Right.
And what does that bring to mind to there?
Mm-hmm.
So to develop that concept.
So if I understand, ekphrasis would be you see the picture and then with your own thought, emotion, culture, you fill in sort of a backstory?
You do. You fill mm-hmm. in the details
mm-hmm.
Based upon your philosophy, your political leanings,
mm-hmm.
Whatever. So do you feel empathy
mm-hmm.
for them? Or do you say, hey, you know, stupid you, why did you do that sort of stuff? So that's, of course, I feel empathy for that. And I write it from a perspective of the father. What mm-hmm. must have been going through his mind? He had his little toddler mm-hmm. strapped to him. Why did he take such a desperate measure
mm-hmm.
to try to swim across the Rio Grande and then realize that they were both drowning? What had to be going through his head
yeah.
in those last few moments of life,
mm-hmm.
the terror that he felt for both him and his daughter Valeria.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, you know, I'm talking about the issue itself, but also to take it to a higher level of thinking too about ekphrasis. And there was a wonderful writer in the Washington Post that brought it to my attention.
Mm-hmm.
And he's an art critic. And so
I love that. I love that little slip of the tongue you just had.
Mm.
Brought it to my intention.
Yes.
When you could have, maybe you were also thinking about brought it to my attention, but you said intention.
Oh, I hadn't realized. I probably did. That was, I probably, attention.
And that,
in, yeah.
And that is so Jerry Fabianic here on All People Considered.
Oh.
That is so you, just so really intentional about what you say, what you write, you know, that your feelings and come out in your articles and come out in your conversations with people. And, you know, came out when you and I served on the school board together.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what a wonderful experience that was. And a lot of it because of you. I got to learn a lot. And we on our board at that time had a person, you, a teacher, a person who had been very involved with the labor union.
Mm-hmm.
Right, in
yes.
Summit County. So
I was the president of my teacher association.
Teachers yep. so had a view of our work on that school board that was very intentional and very informed by a lot of your experience. And I found that to be so valuable as a fellow school board member, that we had someone who had that experience, who could ground us in some informed decision making.
Thank Thank you. Yeah, to me, education is everything. That's where I spent my life. And, you know, I'm still doing it through my articles, through the radio show, to help people. Education can serve one of two purposes. One is to affirm all your biases and pre-knowledge. Everything has been put into your head from day one by family, by community, church, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. That's one purpose of education.
Validation, kind of.
Validation, exactly. Mm-hmm. So you're always looking for that validation of argument. You don't want to hear the other side. The other is to open the mind, to expand it, and to challenge yourself to say, maybe everything I was believing in or thought was true or right or whatever is just not the way I thought it was. So, and, you know, I'm like everyone else, I'm human, and I sometimes go over the edge or I move into that area of judgment. But I really, especially in these last couple of years now, where we got in such an intense time in our culture, try to move away from judgment of the other sides, the other, those who will more than likely disagree with me. And so I always say, I put stuff out there for people to think about. You can accept it, you can reject it, you can do whatever. Once I write it, it's yours. You can do whatever you want. So, but hopefully maybe plant a little seed, you know, like the article on a crisis, and I say, I want to come at it from a point of view of a dad. What dad would not do for his children, what that Mr. Senor Ramirez did for his, at the even at the end there. And that's something I just want people to think about. Okay. Right. And then make your own call when it's done.
Yeah, the human really comes down to the human aspect of, you know, that issue. And quite honestly, I can hardly wait to read this article because I'm getting a little tired of the reporting only because it's so dire. And there seems to be so few actual people that are being highlighted. And, you know, certainly answers seem to be very elusive. And maybe that's just what happens when we get so, we have to deal with so much and, you know, just don't really feel like we found we're finding our way through such a tragic situation. And, you know, as pointed out by that picture, it is absolutely tragic.
Yeah, we've just, it's sad that how we moved and could we ever recover from it? But I'll point a word here, siloization. We become into our silos, but tribalized also. And we find comfort within those around us who are going to affirm everything we already believe. So the Amen course, you know, and it doesn't necessarily have to be in a religious setting. It could be in a political setting, a social setting. So you always have everybody, right. And rather than get with people who disagree, and that's, you know, like I grew up, as I said, in Western Pennsylvania. That blue collar ethic is so integral in me as well. And so while I might not agree with a lot of what perhaps is coming from the blue collar voters in Western Pennsylvania or Michigan, I understand them and I empathize with them, you know, what it's like to live a life like that. And because I haven't forgotten that either. It's not me anymore, but I don't forget it. And I don't judge them. On that, you know, I try not to, you know, and like I say, I'm human and, you know, sometimes just go off the rails a little bit. It's like, pull it back to the center, pull it back. What's your purpose? Like you say, intention here. And if my job as teacher is to open minds, I'm not going to do it by wagging my finger and saying you have to thump, 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 believe this here. Otherwise you're stupid. You're this or that. No, it's about putting out information, another point of view. So can we identify with Senor Ramirez and his desperate attempt at the end in any way? You know, and I only approach it from the role of fatherhood because he was a father. And so to give every father out there and say, okay, put it in your little here and think about it.
Think about what you would do if you were in this situation.
Yeah.
And waiting became unbearable.
Yes.
And so you took that kind of a chance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's when we do open up ourselves to reflection.
Yes.
We really can create the civil discourse that is so badly needed. And, you know, what would you say? So you write your article. I asked you about that. What would you say the state of civil discourse is in our community?
I think, you know, I have a number of Republican friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not a Democrat either. I'm unaffiliated.
Mm-hmm. But of course, am I.
Okay. And everyone knows my liberal bias, you mm-hmm. know, or persuasion. And we still have good conversations when mm-hmm. I see them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. One is the mother of a former student.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have to ask, how's he doing? Mm-hmm. You know, and she's just delighted that I still remember, you know, we don't see each other often. And there's others as well. So, and when you're working, you know, like in a community, like in Georgetown, you know, pulling off an event like these folks are doing now in the town, putting on the 4th of July parade, and you don't care about what your politics are.
Right.
You know, who's organized the parade? Who's going to make sure there's enough potato salad at the park, and who's going to clean up? That's what it's about. And so when you get into smaller communities and when you have these community events, that political difference starts to break down.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unfortunate that in our larger communities, that's, you know, again, it doesn't happen. Maybe it's impossible simply because there's so many people. And that's why we're so blessed, so fortunate to live in such a small, you know, Clear Creek. I mean, we don't even have 10,000 people here full time in the entire county.
Yeah.
You know, so, and we all get to know each other. And there's people, they go, hi, Jerry. And I go, like, do I remember you? Or like, oh, yeah, that was so and so. Yeah. Of course, they have the advantage. You know, I'm in the paper every week, and there's my picture and everything, too. So I justify that way.
Right. So it helps being in a smaller place where we have needs to work together.
Yes.
On whatever it is.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So the, you know, working together on a board or on a committee or on a 4th of July event or on this radio station where we volunteer our time to, you know, keep this radio station an interesting, hopefully you all out there find it an interesting station to listen to. But, you know, it probably does help break things down a little bit because our relationships extend beyond sometimes the polarizing conversations that can happen. But I also think we try very hard, or should all try very hard, to understand the other point of view. And it's there where we can find some kind of common ground to have conversation and further our relationship with each other.
Absolutely, yeah. Because, you know, really, so much of what we believe in is accident of birth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I point that out, that if you're born in the United States and you belong to a religion, it's probably going to be Christian in some form.
Mm-hmm.
If you're born in Saudi Arabia, probably not. You're probably going to be a Sunni Muslim, whereas if you're born in Iran, you'll probably be a Shia Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so religion and all that is an accident of birth in so many ways. We believe what our parents believed in so oftentimes, and we carry on the tradition. Now, there's nothing wrong with that per se, but it's when we get into that judgment to say, I'm right and everybody else is wrong, that's when we get siloized, as they say, and into our little tribals. And, you know, the other is an evil person, a bad person. So to step back from that,
mm-hmm.
you know, to say, look, probably I believe this because so-and-so did, you know. No, me, I'm very fortunate. I always had a love of literature, and I got a I always like to say universe gave me a swift kick in the butt and I was on my way to the journey and one thing led to another. Well, what do you want to be? And I said, teacher. Okay, be a teacher. So then when I am, I get to the high school. Well, we want you to develop the course in American Lit. I go, really? Okay, great. You know, and how did I get into Joseph Campbell and all this here? Because it's just the pathways, the doors open. And when Joseph Campbell always says, once you say yes to the journey, there's no turning back.
Yeah.
There's no jumping off or anything like that. And I'm very fortunate that I've been able to have the journey I have and looking forward to, you know, more adventures down the pike.
Terrific. Well, so it's been so interesting, Jerry Fabianic, talking with you. Tomorrow's the 4th of July.
Yes.
What are you thinking about for our 4th of July tomorrow?
Our as in your own,
our community, maybe even our country. What are you thinking about?
It's a mix on the whole. I want to, and I still do believe that on the whole, we have been a force for good in this country. We're the oldest democracy in the world, possibly in history, even the Roman Republic, I should say. But anyway, and we've gone through some really tough times, especially the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people died because of that. And we so many divisions still there, but we do so many other good things too. You know, like I point out, the reason Nazism, Hitler was defeated in World War II was because of America coming in. And the reason we got in there was because of FDR, Franklin Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. The America at that time was very isolationist. And it was Roosevelt who stepped back and said, whoa, this is big. Mm-hmm. And he was able to lead the country despite his disabilities. Another one of my heroes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the polio that you watch that video Ken Burns made of the Roosevelt. So starting with Teddy right on through. It's on Netflix. It is mesmerized, so gripping. And
so we can still be a force for good.
We still can be. And I bet we need to, you know, not only in human terms, but also climate.
Yeah.
Okay. We've gone off the rails here. My point of view here. We've gone off the rails the last couple of years here.
Mm-hmm.
We need to get back on it, though.
Mm-hmm.
Because the people around the world still look at the United States as the country.
Yeah.
You know, just as we did back 200 years ago when we started this whole crazy thing here called the Republic.
Right.
How many others now have constitutions that followed our lead?
Yeah.
So I think of that, but I also don't lose sight of like in the paper I write here about the moral perversion.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, because we blind spots, slavery,
mm-hmm.
you know, the eradication of the Native Americans,
mm-hmm.
The repression of the workers, women, et cetera, through.
So
not
we can't be a force for good and rest on our laurels. We've got to continue to work to be a force for good in this world. And that is a wonderful message that you've shared and will carry forward into our 4th of July celebration tomorrow. However, you're celebrating out there in Clear Creek County. Make it safe. And I just want to thank Jerry Fabianic for being on my program today. Thanks so much, Jerry.
Thanks, Lori. I just enjoy it. It's so rare I'm on this side of the counter here. So I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
It's great.
It's been fabulous. So thank you all for listening to another edition of All People Considered here on KYGT LPFM 102.7, 103.9 on the FM dial and streaming at clearcreekradio.com worldwide. This program will be repeated on Sunday at 3 o'clock. Should you want to listen to it again or tell your friends to listen to it post 4th of July, and listen again, please, next Wednesday at 5 o'clock. This is Laurie Beckel, your host for All People Considered. Thanks again for listening.
Wow. Yeah, we were about 5 minutes there looking at that, you know, but